Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
So my endeavor here would be to link some commonly accepted principles laid down by Gandhi in the realm of his public life. These are principles that have a close connect with justice, fairness, equity, and I believe that Gandhism can be used as a philosophy to examine the path in which international criminal law is going ahead. Now, before I begin, I would just like to draw an outline of what exactly would the slides be covering. To anchor the philosophy of Gandhi to that of international criminal law, it's very important to identify certain core points which would be the basis of my discussion. Gandhi, as you all may be aware, was a prolific writer who wrote extensively on virtually all aspects of human existence. His written works, you know, span more than 100 volumes, but they have been meticulously collected and documented. But the challenge is, how do you identify what exactly is relevant and what exactly is not? So that's been a challenge. Therefore, I have identified three core aspects on which I would center my arguments around. First is Gandhi's concept of crime. Second, Gandhi's concept of law, legal structure, lawyers, which he analyzed with respect to a broader critique of the idea of modernity and Western civilization. And third, Gandhi's concept of ahimsa, that's non-violence, accompanied values of love and compassion. Gandhi, as you all may be aware, is regarded amongst the most prolific thinkers of the 20th century. His moral and intellectual influence continues to inspire discourse in a wide variety of fields. Gandhi is more commonly known as the architect of India's freedom struggle. But along with that, he is also known as a moral leader, a visionary, who laid down principles that can have application to all aspects of human existence. So to that extent, he was not merely a political leader. He was a moral leader and a spiritual leader who had something more to offer than a normal politician has to offer to the citizens of a country. Another interesting aspect is Gandhi was not an academic or a scholar in the conventional sense of the term. Though he wrote extensively, he did not consider himself to be a professional academic who wrote in a manner that academics would write. So he frequently changed and updated his ideas, and then many of his ideas, he himself says, have not been consistent. They have undergone a change. But despite all that, there is a broad similarity. There is a common thread running through his writings. So, coming to the first concept, that is Gandhi's idea of crime. Gandhi's greatest contribution to crime and criminality is his unique idea rooted in the notions of love, reform, sacrifice, and suffering. Whereas the Western notion of crime has centered around individual accountability, trial, and punishment, Gandhi's focus almost exclusively has remained on reforming the individual. Nothing in criminal law, according to Gandhi, is more important than reforming and bringing a person back who has transgressed. So, whatever be the way in which the criminal justice system is structured, the most fundamental point is, how do you reform a person who has transgressed or has violated a law, bringing him back to society and ensuring that he is saved from the clutches of sin, which, according to Gandhi, is a moral transgression. Crime, according to Gandhi, is a disease, and just like every disease, has a cure. has a cure, crime also has a cure. Crime and the criminal emerge from society, and hence society must also answer for the crime committed by an individual, which means that while an individual may be accountable for what he does, it is also important that society takes the blame for what the individual does, because Gandhi did not make a distinction between the individual and the society. That is in line with his principle of Advaita, that is non-dualism. There isn't a distinction between society and the smaller aspects of society that constitute a whole. The smaller merge into the larger, and the larger is also an integral part of the small, which means if something goes wrong, the entire system gets affected, and the entire system somewhere is supposed to take the blame for the transgressions of even the smaller constituent units. So there's a harmony between the smaller and the larger and the smaller. A famous quote attributed to him is, "Hate the sin and not the sinner." To quote, "No one commits a crime for the fun of it. It is a sign of a diseased mind. The causes of a particular disease should be investigated and removed." For Gandhi, there was no real difference between crime and disease. Both alike displayed poor self-discipline and a lack of social responsibility and concern for others. Both were avoidable, and the comparison of a crime with disease is a metaphorical comparison. Now, what we really need to understand is, according to Gandhi's understanding, there are two aspects of crime. One is, it is a result of a moral transgression on the part of an individual, which arises because of weakness of the human soul. Now, to put that in a much more simpler manner, what he says is, he identifies the human being as comprising of three elements: the mind, the body, and the soul. Every human is a combination of the mind, body, and soul elements. Behavior of an individual, be it good or bad, be it right or wrong, is ultimately the outpouring of the framework of the soul of an individual. So if I am good, or if I do good, it's because my soul is right, my soul is correct, it's proper, it is pure. If I do not do the right thing, if I do something that's wrong, again, that's a problem of my soul, there is an impurity in my soul. Therefore, if you have to answer or find a response to the problem of crime, according to Gandhi, it's essential that you deal with how do you purify the soul of an individual. While it may be a commission of a crime, may be a physical act, I may commit a crime with my hand, it is my soul that is fundamentally responsible for my behavior, that guides my action. And therefore, there has to be a fundamental orientation on reforming the soul if I have to find an answer to the question of behavior. In independent India of the violent, of the non-violent type, there will be crime but no criminals. They will not be punished. Crime is a disease like any other malady and is a product of the prevalent social system. Therefore, all crime, including murder, will be treated as a disease. Whether such an India will ever come into being is under question. If crime is not fundamental to an individual, as Gandhi said, there cannot be a person who's a born criminal. There is no born criminal. A person becomes a criminal on account of two factors. One is the degeneration of his soul, and the other is the degeneration of social norms in society. It's a complex web of moral degeneration of the soul plus the disintegration of society that is actually responsible for the criminal behavior of an individual. So if you have to target crime, if you want to solve crime, you will have to first address the issue as to how do you reform the soul of an individual. Okay. For Gandhi, willpower and self-discipline were not natural endowments but products of upbringing and dominant social ethos. As for malevolence, it too was not natural to man, for even the most hardened and vicious criminals loved someone, at least their parents, wives, husbands, children, or animals. Since crime was basically a product of social organization, It could be very considerably minimized by appropriately changing the latter. So we get two different kinds of interpretations. And a harmonious reading of the two would mean that while crime is the result of a degeneration of the soul, a degeneration of society contributes to that as well. Therefore, a positivistic understanding of punishing an individual will not solve the problem of crime, because punishment and law is something that is external to the soul. So if you want to find an answer to crime and the answer to behavior, you will have to look inside the soul of an individual to see how we can correct that. And that essentially is through an internal process and not necessarily through an external process. And Gandhi was one of the biggest critiques of the legal system, something that I'll come to, which has influenced his ideas on crime and criminal behavior as well. Man, as I've mentioned, man and his deed are two distinct things. Whereas a good deed shall call forth approbation, and a wicked deed disapprobation, the doer of the deed, whether good or wicked, always deserves respect or pity as the case may be. So you don't equate the crime and the criminal together. They're two distinct and two separate things. What was Gandhi's idea on law? Gandhi was critical of lawyers and the legal system. The legal system, according to him, was fundamentally structured to oppress and exploit hapless litigants. Now, Gandhi's opposition to the legal system was based primarily on account of two fundamental notions. One, law is a modern institution. It has its roots in modernity. And modernity is something that fundamentally evolves from the principles of rationality, enlightenment, utilitarian liberalism, and so on. According to him, it ignores the moral question. Something that is good for the greatest number is not necessarily good for everyone. He was a big critique of Benthamite utilitarianism. He said, I'm not concerned with the greatest good or the greatest number. I'm interested in everyone's good. Because he saw the society and the individual as part of one common whole. So, if I benefit, everyone benefits. And if society benefits, everyone benefits. So I'm not interested in the movement or the progress of some at the cost of others. For me, the individual and the society are part of a symbiotic whole. Damage or harm to one affects the other. The second reason why he was critical of this institution was, as I mentioned earlier, since Gandhi viewed crime as a transgression of a degenerate individual on account of his poor soul or his impure soul, he believed that an external institution like law, legal system, lawyers, law courts, cannot really be the answer to that transgression. You cannot impose something from outside and reform myself. It has to come from within. Because crime is something that is internal to the impurity of the soul, the answer to the problem essentially must come from the human soul as well. Therefore, he was critical of the legal system, the legal structure, on account of these two principles. One, on account of the modernistic notion of law, that it ignored the moral question, it ignored the question of everyone's good. He had a problem with the ethics because he felt that the legal structure as it exists in England, as it exists in the common law system, which he was well accustomed to, he said that this is not a system that is fundamentally designed to arrive at truth. And for Gandhi, justice is arrived only when you arrive at the truth. The common law legal system is specifically designed to help one particular party win a case through the channel of the legal structure. It is not an inquiry into truth. And Gandhi said, that is where I have a problem with the legal system. For me, if you arrive at any other determination other than truth, you're not being true to yourself. Gandhi attacked the principle of universalism. He said universal, and this was part of his broader critique against modernity. Universalism, according to him, ignores the idea of local cultures, often degrading them. Since he was basically a fighter against colonialism, he viewed the West as coming with an idea of moral superiority, something which he couldn't understand because he felt that there's no difference between. In fact, he considered the East to be superior to the West in terms of their emphasis on religion, in terms of their emphasis on ethics, values, and morality. The imperialism that the East suffered is specifically on account of the exploitative nature of Western colonialism. And as long as you don't abolish the traits of colonialism or neocolonialism, you cannot have justice in its true sense. In fact, the biggest problem that the ICC faces today on account of allegations of bias from Africa, Asian countries, many Asian countries refusing to join, is on the allegation that this is a form of neocolonialism. And I think Gandhianism and its critique of Western modernism can have an answer to this problem in the sense it seeks to give the third world countries, so to speak, an opportunity to answer their problems in their own way without reliance on a universal system. He was a critique of a universal mechanism. The Kellogg-Briand Pact, the Versailles Treaty, he was critical of all these instruments, the League of Nations. He said, you know, you're not really committed to the question of peace. You're not committed to the question of justice because you have colonies all over the world. So when you enter into a peace treaty, you should remember that you are oppressing the people of your colonies like anything. So your attempt at justice is not an honest one. And this would be my last point. Gandhi is most well known for his idea of satyagraha, which is, you know, the quest for truth or the desire to hold on to truth in every sense of the term. Now, this basically has two elements. Resist oppression and disobey civilly when you're required to do that. This is not a criminal act according to Gandhi, this is a civil act. And this is a moral obligation because if you do not resist oppression, you're siding with the oppressors and you're part of the oppression. Every individual has an innate, fundamental, natural right to resist or oppress something that is not moral. So if you find that a law is not moral, it's not correct, an institution is not correct, you have a right to either boycott it or refuse to follow its norms. Can we see the boycott or a talk of a boycott of the ICC by African nations in this sense? If you view it from a pure Gandhian sense, there is an innate right in every nation to refuse to be part of a system which they feel is fundamentally flawed or biased, which does not meet the threshold of justice which they understand it to be. The forceful referral of Sudan to the ICC by the UNSC, even where, you know, the country was not a member of the ICC, but under a universal system under which you do not have a choice, but you can be referred to a system of accountability without taking into account your view, your will, your protestations, subjecting. You cannot subject the national to the international because they are part of a symbiotic whole. The global cannot do well by subjugating the national, nor can the national do well by subjugating the global. So any system which tries to achieve a global good by subjugating the national, or somebody tries to achieve good for the national by subjugating the individual, will not succeed because ultimately the good of an individual lies with the good of the family. Good of the family lies with the good of the society. Society with the state. State with the country and country with the globe. The principle of Advaita, non-dualism. I am not different from you. Your good is my good. My good is your good. This is Ahimsa, non-violence, which I have covered. Now, before I conclude, I would want to mention one thing. Gandhi is specifically relevant for international criminal law on one more account. His approach to dealing with injustice, or his approach to dealing with criminal justice, very simply was, approach an offender with love, compassion, and mercy. And to the person who committed the crime, his greatest advice was, you confess your crime before an authority who has the authority to take the confession. The best way to avoid violence is, the state needs to approach the offender with love, compassion, and mercy. Which means, adopt a mechanism that is outside the framework of trial and punishment, and to an offender, subject yourself to the system. Never fight, never revolt. Always subject yourself to the other person. That's how you win the person over. You can't win a person by fighting over. But if you surrender yourself to the other person, so the state should surrender itself to the person committing the crime, and the accused or the person committing the crime should surrender himself to the state. When both of these things happen, you eliminate the need for a criminal trial. You eliminate the need for a legal system because you have brought the parties together. If I've committed a crime and I confess before you, what's the need for a trial? You can just send me, and if I willingly accept the punishment, I stand on a morally superior footing to you. Never resist, never impose violence. If you have the courage to attack me and kill me, do kill me if you can. But tomorrow you'll regret, because you will understand that you are morally weaker than I am. If you have the capacity to harm me, if you have the will to harm me, do that. I'm subjecting myself to you. I'm giving myself to you. But you won't do that if you have a sense of morality that is pure. Which means violence can never be met with violence. Violence has to be met with peace. You have to win the person over by showing him mercy, compassion, and wisdom. With this, I conclude my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.